Thank you very much, Cheryl. Very interesting indeed, and I'm sure when we get an opportunity for questions later on, thank you, people will have many of those, and there's obviously a vast area there to cover, and it reinforces the point that I made earlier about the number of inquiries going on to the sector at the moment, that the sector has a loud voice in that and puts its views forward. And I'm sure that James very much appreciated the free plug for his session tomorrow afternoon. I'd like to introduce now Mark Pesce, inventor, writer, educator and futurist. He's the man who is known internationally as the man who fused virtual reality with the World Wide Web to invent VRML. I'm sure he'll explain that to you if you'd like. Mark has been exploring the frontiers of media and technology for a quarter of a century, and he currently holds an appointment as Honorary Associate in the Digital Cultures Program at the University of Sydney, and in 2006 founded Future Street, a Sydney media and technology consultancy. Can you welcome Mark?
Good morning, everybody. So I'm going to take a little bit more theoretical approach to how all the transformations that are underway with media and social media are actually affecting the way we work as organizations. Let's see. There we go. Excellent. So the New York Times, I read an article last week about something that's taking place in the state of North Carolina, an interesting experiment since the beginning of February this year. It's called the Birds and Bees Text Line. It invites teenagers with any questions about sex or the mysteries of dating to SMS their questions to a telephone number. That number connects teenagers to an on-duty adult at the Adolescent Pregnancy Prevention Campaign. And within 24 hours, a teenager gets a reply to the text message. Now, those questions run from the very run-of-the-mill, when is a person not a virgin anymore, to the unusual, if you have sex underwater, do you need a condom? To the utterly heartrending, hey, I'm preg and don't know how to tell my parents. Can you help? Now, the Birds and Bees text line is a response to the slowly rising number of teenage pregnancies in North Carolina, which bottomed out in about 2003. Teenagers in North Carolina are given state-mandated abstinence-only sex education. But with the Birds and Bees text line, they now have access to another resource. It's unmediated by teachers or by parents, and it's designed to prevent another generation of teenage pregnancies. And although it's very early days yet, there seems to be a positive response to the Birds and Bees text line. Teenagers are using it. Now, it's precisely because the Birds and Bees text line is unmediated by parental control that it has aroused the ire of some of the more conservative elements in North Carolina. A man named Bill Brooks, who's the president of the North Carolina Family Policy Council, a conservative group, complained to the New York Times about the lack of oversight. He said, "If I couldn't control access to this service, I'd simply turn off the texting on the teenagers' phones. When it comes to the internet, parents are best advised to put blockers on the computers and keep the computer in a central place in the home. But kids can have access to their cell phones when they're away from parental influence. It can't be controlled." Now, if I had stuffed words into a straw man's mouth, I couldn't have come up with a better summation of the situation we're all in right now. Young and old, rich and poor, liberal and conservative. There are certain points when it becomes particularly obvious, and that's true with the Birds and Bees text line. This example really only amplifies our sense of the present as a really undiscovered country, something we've all suddenly been thrust into together. Conservatives, of course, will naturally react conservatively. They'll seek to preserve what's worked in the past. Bill Brooks is speaking for a large cohort of people who feel increasingly lost in this bewildering present. But let us assume for a moment that conservatism was in the ascendant. Now, that's not the case in the United States, but it could be said that in Australia, the Rudd administration is in some ways much more conservative than the Howard government. Let us assume that Bill Brooks and the people for whom he speaks could have the birds and bees text line shut down. Would that then be the end of it? Would we have stuffed the genie back into the bottle? The answer, unquestionably, is no. Everyone who has ever used or heard of the birds or bees text line would be familiar with what it does and how it works. Once demonstrated, it becomes much easier to reproduce. It would be very easy to take the functions performed by the birds and bees text line and crowdsource them, sharing the load across any number of dedicated volunteers who might, through some clever software, automate most of the tasks needed to distribute the messages among the cloud of volunteers. Even if it took a little bit of grant money to set up and get going, that kind of money would be available from donors who feel that teenage sexual education is a good thing. In other words, the same engine which powers Wikipedia can be put to work on any number of different platforms. The power of sharing allows individuals to come together in great clouds of activity and allows them to focus that activity around a single task. It could be an encyclopedia, or it could be providing reliable and judgment-free information about sexuality to teenagers. The form matters not at all. What matters is that it's happening, and it's happening all around us everywhere throughout the world. This cloud, this new thing, this is really what has Bill Brooks scared, because it is quite literally out of control. It arises naturally out of the human condition of hyperconnection. We are so much better connected than we were even a decade ago that this connectivity is now breeding new human capabilities. The first of these capabilities is the pooling and sharing of knowledge, or hyperintelligence. Consider, everyone who reads Wikipedia is potentially as smart as the smartest person who's ever contributed to Wikipedia. Wikipedia has effectively banished ignorance born from the want of knowledge. The birds and bees text line is another form of hyperintelligence, connecting adults with knowledge to teenagers in desperate need of that knowledge. Hyperconnectivity also means that we can carefully watch one another. We can learn from one another's behaviors at the speed of light. This new capability, or hypermimesis, means that new behaviors, such as the birds and bees text line, can be seen and can then be copied and replicated very quickly. Finally, hypermimesis means that communities of interest can form around particular behaviors, clouds of potential. These communities range from the mundane to the arcane, and they are everywhere already online. But only recently have they learned that they can discover, that they can translate their community into doing. They can put hyperintelligence to work for the benefit of that community. Now that's the methodology of the Adolescent Pregnancy Prevention Campaign. That's the methodology of Wikipedia. It's the methodology of WikiLeaks, which seeks to provide a safe place for whistleblowers who want to share the goods on those who defraud or censor or suppress. This is the methodology of an organization called Anonymous, which seeks to expose Scientology as a ridiculous cult. How many more examples do we need to list before we admit that the rules have changed and that the smooth functioning of power has been terrifically interrupted by these other forces, now powers in their own right? Now, I'm not telling you that we should be expecting a revolution. We will not see masses of hyperconnected people storming the winter palaces of power. This is not a proletarian revolt. It is instead rather more subtle and complex. The entire nature of power has changed, as have the burdens of power. Power has always carried with it the burden of omniscience. That is, those at the top of the hierarchy have to possess a complete knowledge of everything important happening everywhere under their purview. When they lose grasp of that knowledge, that's the place where people stage coups or palace revolutions or popular revolts. The new power that flows from the cloud of hyperconnectivity carries a different burden, the burden of connection. In order to maintain the cloud and our presence within it, we are beholden to it. We must maintain each of our social relationships, each of the informational relationships, each of the knowledge relationships, and each of the mimetic relationships within the cloud. Without that constant activity, the cloud dissipates, evaporating into nothing at all. Now, this is not a particularly new phenomenon. There's something from anthropology known as Dunbar's number. And that number shows that we are demonstrably beholden to a tribe of our peers, roughly 150 individuals who can find a place in our heads. In pre-civilization, the cloud was the tribe. Now, should the members of the tribe interrupt the constant reinforcement of the social and informational and knowledge-based and mimetic relationships which make up that tribe, the tribe begins to dissolve, and that happens to a tribe when it grows beyond Dunbar's number. Now, in this hyper-connected era, when we don't live in tribes anymore, we can pick and choose the human connections that determine that need reinforcement. And the lines of reinforcement shape the scope of the power that we have. Studies of Japanese teenagers using mobiles and 20-somethings using Facebook have shown that most of the time, this activity is directed to a small circle of peers, basically six or seven other people. This co-presence, as it's named, is probably a modern echo of the ancient behavior of communicating among the family unit. Now, while we might desire to extend our power and our capabilities through networks of hyperconnections, the cost associated with such investments is very high. Time spent in the far-flung cloud is time lost on the network closer to home. Yet individuals will often dedicate themselves to a cause greater than themselves, despite the high price paid because they're drawn by some higher ideal. The Obama campaign proved a very interesting example of the price of connectivity. During the Democratic primary for the state of New York, which Hillary Clinton was absolutely assumed she would win because it was her home state, so many individuals contacted the Obama campaign through its website that the campaign itself became quickly overloaded with the number of connections that it was expected to maintain. By election day, the entire campaign staff in New York had retreated from the website they'd set up and they were back to using mobiles. They had detached from the cloud of connectivity they'd used the web to foster, and instead focused their connectivity among that unit of six or seven other people that they were co-present connected with. So the enormous cloud of power that could have been put to work in New York lay dormant, unorganized. It talked to itself through the Obama website, but it was effectively disconnected from the Obama campaign. Now, for each of us, connectivity carries a high price. For every organization that attempts to harness hyperconnectivity, the price is even higher. With very few exceptions, organizations are structured along hierarchical lines. Power flows from bottom to top. Not only does this create a burden of omniscience at the highest levels of the organization, it also fundamentally mismatches the flows of power in the cloud. When the hierarchy comes into contact with the energized cloud, the discharge from the cloud to the hierarchy can completely overload the hierarchy. That's the power of hyperconnectivity. Another example, again from the Obama campaign, demonstrates this power. Project Houdini was touted by the Obama campaign as a system which would get the grassroots of the campaign to funnel their get-out-the-vote results into a centralized database. Now, keep in mind, Americans are not required to vote, so getting out the vote is the key to winning an election. And that database would then be used to track down individuals who hadn't voted in order to offer them assistance in getting to the polling station. The campaign grassroots received training in Project Houdini and went through a field test of the software and then waited for election day. Now, on election day, Project Houdini lasted no more than 15 minutes before it crashed under the incredible number of empowered individuals who attempted to plug data into Project Houdini. They went back to using phones. Although months in the making, Project Houdini showed that a centralized and hierarchical system for campaign management can't actually cope with a cloud of grassroots organizers. Now, in the 21st century, we have two oppositional methods of organization. We have the hierarchy and we have the cloud. Each of them carries with them their own costs and their own strengths. neither has proven to be wholly better than the other. One could make an argument that they'll both have roles in the future, and we'll be spending a lot of time learning which works best in a given situation. We have already learned that these organizational types are mostly incompatible unless very specific steps are taken. The cloud will overpower the hierarchy, or the hierarchy will dissipate the cloud. We need to think about the interfaces that can connect one to the other. That's the area that all organizations, and very specifically nonprofit organizations, will need to work through in the coming years. Learning how to harness the power of the cloud will mark the difference between a modest success and an overwhelming success. Yet working with the cloud will present organizational challenges of the highest order. There is no way that a hierarchy can work with the cloud without becoming fundamentally altered by the experience. Now, all organizations are confronted with these two utterly divergent methodologies for organizing their activities, the tower and the cloud. The tower seeks to organize everything in hierarchies and information flows going from bottom to top. The cloud is not formally organized. It pools its information resources. It has no center of power. Despite all of its obvious weaknesses, the cloud can still transform to a formidable power capable of overwhelming the tower. To push the metaphor a little further, the cloud can become a storm. Now, how does this happen? What is it that turns a cloud into a storm? Jimmy Wales, the founder and promoter of Wikipedia, has said that any language variant version of Wikipedia comes down to the dedicated effort of five individuals. Once he spies five individuals at work on the Pashto or Kazakh or Xhosa versions of Wikipedia, he knows that version of Wikipedia will become a success. In other words, five people need to take the lead, leading everyone else in the cloud with their dedication, with their selflessness, and their openness. This number probably holds true in a cloud of any sort. Find five like-minded individuals, and the transformation from cloud to storm will begin. At the end of that transformation, there's still no hierarchy. There are instead concentric circles of involvement. In the innermost, there are those five or more incredibly dedicated individuals, and then a larger circle of a greater number who work with the inner five or more as time and opportunity allow, and so on outward, until we reach the individuals who simply contribute a word or a grammatical change, and who have no real connection with the inner circle except in a commonality of purpose. This is the model for Wikipedia. This is the model for WikiLeaks. This is the model for Anonymous. This is the cloud model fully actualized as a storm. At this point, the storm can challenge any tower. But the storm doesn't have things all its own way. To present a challenge to a tower is to invite the full possession of its full presentation of its own power, which is very rude and very physical and potentially very deadly. Wikipedians who are at work on the Farsi version of Wikipedia face arrest and persecution by Iran's Revolutionary Guards and its religious police. Just a few weeks ago, the contents of the Australian government's internet blacklist was posted to WikiLeaks, and immediately thereafter, the German government invaded the home of a man who controls the domain for WikiLeaks in Germany. The tower still controls most of the power apparatus in the world, and that power can be put to work to squeeze any potential competitors. But what happens when you try to squeeze a cloud? Effectively, nothing at all. Wikipedia has no head to decapitate. Jimmy Wales is a cheerleader, and he's a face for the press, but his presence is not strictly necessary. There are 2,000 Wikipedians who handle the day-to-day work. Locking them all away, while possible, would only encourage further development in the cloud as other individuals move to take their places. Moreover, most attempts to disrupt the cloud only end by making the cloud more resilient. This has been conclusively demonstrated in the evolution of darknets, private file sharing networks, which grew up as the legal and widely available file sharing networks such as Napster and Kazaa were shut down by the copyright holders. Attacks on the cloud only improve the networks within the cloud, only make the leaders more dedicated, only increase the information and knowledge sharing within the cloud. Trying to disperse a storm only ends by intensifying it. Now, these are not idle speculations. The tower will try to constrain the storm by any means necessary. The 21st century will increasingly look like a series of collisions between towers and storms. Each time the storm emerges triumphant, the tower will become more radical and more determined in its efforts to disperse the storm, which will only result in a more energized and more intensified storm. This is not a game that the tower can win by fighting. Only by opening up and adjusting itself to the structure of the cloud can the tower find any way forward. So what then is leadership in the cloud? It is not like leadership in the tower. It is not a position wrought from power, but is authority in its other more primary meaning, authority in the sense of being master. Authority in the cloud is drawn from dedication, or to use a more precise language, love. Love is what holds the cloud together. You ask Jimmy Wales what holds Wikipedia together, he says it's love. People are attracted to the cloud because they are in love with the aim of the cloud. The cloud is truly an affair of the heart. And these affairs of the heart will be the engines that drive 21st century business, politics, and community. Author and pundit Clay Shirky has said, the internet is better at stopping things than starting them. I reckon he's actually quite wrong there. The internet is very good at starting things that stop things, but it is very good at starting things. Making the jump from the amorphous cloud of potentiality to a forceful storm requires the love of just five people. That's not much to ask. If you can't get that many people in love with your cause, it may not be worth pursuing. Now, all 21st century organizations need to recognize and adapt to the cloud. It's either that or face the death of a thousand cuts, the slow ebbing of power away from hierarchical structured organizations into the newer forms of organization which are supplanting them. But it need not be this way. It need not be an either or choice. It could be a future of and, where both forms continue to exist peacefully. But that will only happen if the hierarchy can recognize the power of the cloud, and that means you. All of you have your own hierarchical organizations, because that's how organizations have always been run. Yet, each of you are surrounded already by your own clouds, community organizations, both in the real world and online, bulletin boards, blogs, all of the other Web 2.0 supports for the sharing of connectivity, for information, knowledge, and power. You are already halfway invested in the cloud, whether or not you realize it. And that's also true for the people you serve, your clients and your customers and your interest groups. You can't simply ignore the cloud. So how should organizations proceed? First, do not be scared of the cloud. It might be some time before you come to love the cloud or even to trust it, but you must at least move to a place where you are not frightened by a constituency which uses the cloud to assert its own empowerment. Reacting out of fright will only lead to an arms race, a series of escalations where your hierarchy attempts to contain the cloud, and a cloud is faster and smarter or more agile than you could ever hope to be. And it will outwit you again and again. Second recommendation, like likes like. If you can permute your organization so that it looks more like a cloud, you'll have an easier time working with the cloud. Case in point, because of message discipline, only a very few people are allowed to speak for an organization. Yet, because of the exponential growth in connectivity and Web 2.0 technologies, everyone in your organization has more opportunities to speak for your organization than ever before. Can you release control over message discipline? Can you empower your organization to speak for itself from any point of contact? Yes, this sounds dangerous, and yes, there are some dangers involved, but the cloud wants to be spoken to authentically, and authenticity has many competing voices, not a single monolithic tone. Third and finally, remember that we are all involved in a growth process. The cloud of last year is not the cloud of next year. The answers that satisfied a year ago are not the answers that will satisfy a year from now. We are all booting up very quickly into an alternate form of social organization, which is only just now spreading its wings and testing its worth. Beginnings are very delicate times, and the future is going to be shaped by our actions in the present. This means that there are enormous opportunities to extend the capability of existing organizations simply by harnessing them to the changes underway. It also means that that tragedies await those who fight the tide of the times too single-mindedly. Our culture has already rounded the corner and has made the transition to the cloud. It remains to be seen which of our institutions and organizations can adapt themselves and find their way forward into sharing power. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark. And I, for one, am glad that we've reached the point where one of the greatest put-downs I've had during my life about having my head in the clouds is now a badge of honour. We will now open up to a panel with Cheryl and Mark. As I said earlier on, if you can wait till the microphone comes to you in order to be able to ask a question. We've got a bit of a Q&A session, and I'm sure Cheryl and Mark will do their best to deal with whatever questions or comments you might want to make. Do we have a first question from somewhere?
I've got one.
We've got a mic coming. Yeah, right behind you.
My name's Ian Stevenson. This is a question for Cheryl. My experience in the not-for-profit sector in dealing with government through grants is that it's often a terribly oppressive relationship where, you know, they control the money and basically get you to work your guts out in a way that they never do. It